Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publicize your book. And there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome to the New Books Network. My name's Piers Kelly. And today I'm talking to Dr. Maya Poncinet, a linguist at the University of Western Australia, who will soon be taking up a CNRS position at the Laboratoire Dynamique du Langage in Lyon. Full disclosure, Maya is a longtime colleague and friend. Maya, welcome to the podcast.
Hello, thank you very much for the invitation, and it's lovely to be here having a chat with you this morning.
You're the author of many papers on language and two books. The first, published in 2014, is titled The Language of Emotions, The Case of Darlebon, Australia. And more recently, you've written Difference and Repetition in Language Shift to a Creole, The Expression of Emotions, and that's published by Routledge. This recent book centres on the question of what really happens when a group of people who have spoken their heritage language since time immemorial shift to speaking a completely different language. One popular assumption is that once you stop using your traditional language, you also lose all the cultural perspectives and language-specific meanings that are embedded in it. This view tends to be premised on the related idea that linguistic structures have the effect of constraining or at least organizing our experience of the world in irreducible ways. These are just two of the truisms that you challenge in Difference and Repetition. But before we talk about this book and all of its important ideas, I want to start by asking about you. What first brought you to linguistics? And as a linguist or anthropological linguist, what are some of the burning questions that underlie your research?
Wow, that's a big question. First, perhaps I would like to say that, yes, I have one part of my work that dealt specifically with, you know, language shift and what happens when people change language and this link between language and culture. Perhaps I also work specifically on expressivity and emotions in language. So my work on language shift is a part of that. And that interest in expressivity and emotions is anchored in an initial interest that I have had, which was not in linguistics, but in the mind, in philosophy of mind, internal states, you know, internal processes such as pain, and including emotions. And what really fascinates me with these internal states is that they are internal. They happen in our mind. They happen, in a sense, you know, to say it in a non-theoretical way, they happen inside us. Nevertheless, humans communicate about them. We seem to, you know, be able to project what happens to others regarding these internal states. And this ability challenges the other side of the equation, which is this idea of the opacity of other minds, right? So, of course, I cannot open your head and see what's inside you, but we have all these communication means, including language, that allow us to project enough of these internal states from other people to function as a society and to also develop empathy for others, etc. So that's, in this way, I think language is a very important tool, and I'm fascinated by this process of unpacking the invisible. So that's what this is, this role of language that drew me to the study of language and to the study in particular of how people talk about internal states, including emotions. And yeah, so.
Okay, yeah, I think when you talk about internal states and the invisible, I'm thinking kind of almost tangentially to that. I've always enjoyed in your work the way that you take you're not just talking about internal states, you're talking about the tacit assumptions also that people carry about language, and you have a way of bringing them into light. For example, you often challenge readers not to exoticize minority languages, and you do this by using cross-linguistic comparative examples to illustrate all the range of similarities as well as differences in the modes of expression across the world. And another thing I enjoy about your work is that it, in aggregate, it sort of undermines this centuries-old prejudice that Indigenous languages or languages spoken within small-scale traditional societies are somehow in deficit when it comes to representing abstractions. And by contrast, it's the big global languages that are seen to be ideally suited to, you know, science, reason, thought, and other abstract ideas. And Indigenous languages, meanwhile, are said to be designed for the concrete and the practical.
Yes, I found something completely different in my in my work. I mean, I found that obviously there are many words and ways that everybody in the world, I suppose, and in particular the Taliban speakers I was working with, of course, they also talk about internal states.
Yeah. So let's talk about your book, Difference and Repetition in Language Shift to a Creole. Tell me what it was that you were seeking to understand, and what was the data that you drew on for it?
Yeah. So here I am now. You can picture me as, someone with an interest in language and internal state, knowledge, emotions, and having also a past of an acquaintance with the community that dated back to my work as a linguist. So I was interacting and working with Taliban speakers to document the way they speak about emotions in their work. So I spent many years doing this and studying Taliban, which is an endangered language. And that resulted in my first book, which, for which I worked with speakers such as Maggie Toukoumba, Queenie Brennan, Lily Bennett, who were master speakers of Taliban. Meanwhile, these were elders, and in fact, Maggie and Lily have already passed away. And meanwhile, I was also obviously interacting with the rest of the community and with them using another language, which is not Taliban, which is Creole. So Creole is spelled K-R-I-O-L, and it's a new language, a type of language that is called a Creole, which is a sort of like a contact language that has features of English along with features of the local Australian languages. And that was the language I was interacting, we were using to interact on a day-to-day basis while I was documenting Taliban. And that sort of triggered my curiosity of, asking myself, well, what happened in this transfer? You have some people in this community who speak Taliban, and then a majority of people who speak Creole. What happens to the expression and description of internal state in this change? So I decided to, I had done a lot of documentation work, recording people speaking, narrating emotional stories in Taliban, etc. And I decided to do the same work in Creole. So I ended up with two corpora recording with speakers. So speakers of Creole who contributed to the corpus in this language are people like Ingrid Ashley, Angela Ashley, Maggie Jensen, Bonita Bennett, Tarana Manita, and many more. So I had these two corpora, and I compared the features that I found in each.
Yeah, that's really amazing to have those rich parallel corpora, basically. Just going to step back a bit, at the very beginning of the book, you give a really nice overview of Worfian inquiries into language. In other words, you consider the current state of research into the purported effects of particular language forms on speakers and perceptions and behaviours. This is the linguistic relativity hypothesis. And you conclude this section by saying that even with all these new and wonderful empirical studies and methods, there is currently little scientific consensus about the correlations between language, culture, and thought, let alone any causal directionality. How do you see intellectual progress in this area of linguistics, and what's the way forward in your view?
Yes, so I think, one thing to say now is that, of course, as one finds out quickly if they read my book, what I found when I compared Creole and Talabon in this way is that there may be some differences between the languages, but essentially language adapts. So language is driven by culture, at least in the case of the expression of emotions, rather than the opposite. Language is plastic. This is in a sense a counterexample to linguistic relativity, because relativity tells you that language could impose certain things to the way people think. And I think there's a lot of counterexamples. So the field of studies on linguistic relativity is interesting because there's lots of case studies, lots of researchers, colleagues have looked into specific cases, and there's a lot of contradictory evidence in a sense. So, well, it's not contradictory, but we have some cases where linguistic relativity does seem to, you know, there's something to it. So the language of space, for instance, is an area, the way people describe space, it's an area where there seems to be some evidence that there is a correlation between language and cognition and behavior. But then you have lots of counter examples with studies of either space in language shift context or studies on something else. And I think what's probably perhaps at the moment, there's a need for some kind of synthesis. So if I had the time, or if someone else has the time, I think it would be fantastic to do a sort of meta-analysis of these, of all the research that is currently available on linguistic relativity and related topics, and try to generalize. So, and it wouldn't be to try and find, like, you know, the answer, like yes or no, but simply to say, okay, in context X, maybe that's the sort of context where you could expect some influence of language. In context Y, on the other hand, or in Y or Z semantic domain, don't expect it, because we see that this is not where it tends to happen. So something of a step towards generalization of the results, of the diversity of results that we currently have on linguistic relativity.
Yeah, that's great. And I realized when I asked you that I'd skipped ahead a question by mistake, but we can go back, because this is good, in fact, that speaking of generalizations, you developed, I wanted to ask you, after you developed this data set and you've been working with these people, and you obviously you don't develop a data set without a question in mind. So what was it that you were, what was it that you found out when you looked more carefully at this Creole language material and Talabon?
Yeah. So yes, it's interesting. Like, yeah, I agree. You don't develop a corpus without a question in mind, but the question can be more or less specific, or can be sort of general. So the underlying motive for developing my corpora was I want to be able to compare the way people talk about emotions in these two languages, or express emotions in these two languages. And I really didn't have a preconceived idea of what I would find. And I was quite surprised initially when I saw things unfold literally before my eyes as I was recording, you know, things in Creole, and I already had the knowledge of Talabon. So what I found is that a lot of the Creole language, its fabric is very different from Talabon in terms of its morphology, etc. So in a sense, if you like, its sort of basic grammatical profile is very different. But the languages are far apart in their makeup. But you do find that Creole has included a lot of features that allow its speakers to say things and package linguistic messages in the same way as Talabon speakers would package them. So that comes with words, for instance, that may sound English, because that's what Creoles do. They borrow language, they borrow words, forms, from the dominant language. So in Creole, words come from English, but their meanings tend to be often close to the meaning of words you find in Talabon. We can give examples of that. And it's the same with construction. So I found that sometimes Creole doesn't have a certain type of construction, grammatical construction, because of the grammatical makeup of it. And while Talabon has this construction, but speakers take something else to express the same meaning. So that's what I was saying earlier when I said language is plastic. You know, you take a group of people, give them a number of, you know, a sort of a basic lexical grammatical tool. They're going to, you know, manage with it to say whatever they need to say, and they will tweak it. They will modulate it in a way that allows them to express what they want. So that's basically what I found. And I think we often forget, this is something I notice also when I explain these things to students, for instance, we think of language shift as translation. So we think that, you know, I speak English and I also speak French. So of course I operate in English within an English speaking community and in French within a French speaking community. So if I try to translate the two languages, I'm constrained by the norms imposed by these two communities. But if I was to, you know, speak English for several years with a bunch of people who don't speak French and we have to communicate in English, but everybody has a different linguistic background, within a very short time, this English that we would be using would not look like English at all. It would just drift away. And this is just a natural fact. So language shift is not translation. People who have shifted from, say, not even Creole, but say, you know, any Australian language to, say, Aboriginal English or any variety of English in the world, they don't translate things from their older language to their newer language. They just use this new grammatical tool to express whatever they want, and they modify the lexical grammatical code as they wish because they're not constrained by any norm.
Right. Yeah. That's really interesting. And I just... But before we go into some of the great examples in your book and talk about the text of your book, I want to briefly go back to motivations or research motivations, because I enjoy the dilemma that you brought up at the beginning, namely that folk assumptions that language embodies culture, or who knows, language that shift equals translation or whatever. These folk assumptions can, in fact, be politically effective when it comes to seeking support for endangered languages, even though this equation is by no means straightforward. And this is not just a folk assumption perpetuated by the mainstream. It's one that's often embraced by speakers of traditional languages. You point out that one of the problems with this formulation, that language somehow embodies and holds culture, is that it stigmatizes those who have had their language taken away from them, and it inadvertently casts them as culturally inauthentic, in inverted commas. Can you perhaps talk about cases of this that you've personally encountered where someone has taken on this assumption and followed it through towards this unfortunate implication?
Yes, sure. So first, I would like to say perhaps here that I do not mean to deny anybody's right to feel attached to their language and to feel that language is... In fact, language is a cultural asset. So, right. You know, certainly language is just like art or music or poetry. So certainly I don't want to deny if someone feels that their language is important to them because it brings them closer to something that they feel is part of their identity. I'm certainly not denying this. In fact, it should be embraced and supported where needed. But it's more like the sort of like the... Perhaps the overly emphasizing this can be dangerous. In terms of one practical case where people are, you know, being asked to be authentic and language is actually instrumentalized as a means to measure authenticity, that is native title. So the native title law in Australia is a legal framework that allows for people who are traditional owners and custodians of the continent to claim legal ownership on their land, which is ironic because, you know, they are the owner of this land, but if they want a legal title to it, they need to make a claim and go through often very long legal cases. And language is can be used, is often used in these cases to demonstrate ties to the land, but also the other way around. So then if you have, if you don't speak this traditional language, it's a harder case to make that maybe, you know, the way you speak English still retains traces of the, like I said before, of your older language. So this is very, very tricky because it's a very, very sharp double-edged sword that, you know, language often plays against people in this context. And also it's been well documented by colleagues such as Michael Walsh, for instance, who has observed that in the legal system in court cases, language is really used in this way, you know, to discard people, to dismiss people's claims because they're, if they speak English, they're inauthentic, for instance. Mm. So this is some, this is an area where it's operationalized. But going back to the question of internalization, of course, you know, there's, like I said before, there's nothing wrong with feeling attached to, you know, your linguistic identity. For instance, if you are Greek and, you know, you live in Australia, you're Australian, but you also have, your parents are Greek, but you don't speak Greek and you feel that you have this inkling to go back to Greece and learn the language. I mean, there's nothing wrong with that. Perhaps it's even a nice thing because it's a drive in life and it's achievable, right? So, but I've seen cases where, for instance, I remember this young man that was a long time ago in Arnhem Land where I work. This young man who I had a conversation with him and a brief conversation with him where he explained to me that he felt that Creole was brainwashed from English. So Creole was his language, you know, and he described it as brainwashed from English, which is sad. And he also stated that, you know, for him, he felt that the traditional languages were too hard to learn and so on and so forth. And as it happened, this person committed suicide shortly after this conversation, which, I mean, I don't want to draw, you know, I don't want to say that it is his linguistic, his sense of his linguistic lack of belonging that drew him to this sad end, tragic end. But certainly it probably didn't help. And it was part of a general, difficulty with his identity.
Yeah. All right. Well, let's talk about emotions. You focus on ways of expressing emotions in Dalabon, and you compare these to counterpart forms in Creole or the variety of Creole as it's spoken by Dalabon people today. Why did you choose to investigate the domain of emotions in particular?
Thank you for asking the question, because I answered this earlier saying that it stemmed from my own interest in internal state, you know, and processes of mind, which is like very abstract kind of Western Cartesian approach. The reality is that I think this also maps onto local interests, and the interest for knowledge, for instance, is very much a cultural interest. But also, when I started working as a documentary linguist and recording, which happened many years after I started working in the community in another role. So I started working, recording people that I knew quite well, and I came across this question of emotions and found that a lot of the female speakers, the people I worked with who were female speakers of the language, were very interested in talking about emotion words, and I discovered all these words with body parts that you know encapsulated quite fine emotional meaning, and speakers were really keen to discuss them. So that's what initially prompted me to narrow the focus shift the focus slightly from internal state, knowledge, culture, to specifically emotion and expressivity.
Yeah, that's great. It's wonderful to be led by speakers in that way. Could you perhaps give us some comparative examples of emotion expressions in Dalabon and in Creole and what you learned from them?
Well, one thing is that there's, like I said, like, of course, you can look at either the resemblances or the differences. In terms of resemblances, there's a lot of Creole words that sound perfectly English, but in fact, their meaning is the same as the meaning of a Taliban word. So For instance, an important, I guess, an important value in the moral etiquette of Taliban people or you know, people in Arnhem Land is what has been called compassion in the anthropological literature. So it's basically the sense that you need to have empathy for other people, in particular relatives, in particular kin, and that you need to, feel sorry for them, you need to feel grief, you need to worry about them if they're sick. But also coming with this, there's a sense that this feeling, this empathetic feeling, is equated with attitudes of and behaviors of sharing, caring in practice. So you help someone, you care for somebody if they're sick, you and in particular sharing material goods such as food. So there is a sort of cluster which is both emotional and behavioral, which encompasses these empathetic emotions and the related behaviors of sharing and caring. And one thing that I found interesting is that there is this, so in Creole, the way to express compassion is with the word sorry in English, in Creole, that, but the word comes from English. Mm. It sounds exactly the same as the English sorry. And indeed, to express compassion in Creole, you're going to say feel sorry. So in Taliban, it's marbun, it's a verb. In Creole, it's feel sorry. And these words pattern in the same way. But equally, in Creole, feel sorry sounds very similar to the English feel sorry. Mm. However, in Creole, there's also another way you can use the verb, which is you say that someone, you can say, oh, can you sorry me blah paka, which means that you use the verb in a different way where it's not just describing your state, it's describing someone's action to give you something out of compassion. So perhaps you're in need for food and you go and see a relative. And you say, oh, can you sorry me blataga? Can you give me a bit of food out of your compassion for me because you're a relative? And so that's really interesting because this word, which, you know, on the face of it sounds perfectly equal to English, and you could speak Creole for ages, for year, with years, without encountering the other expression. But it shows that people have taken this little bit of word and just done something which came from English and done something with it, which is exactly the same as you would do in Taliban with the verb marbun, which you can use exactly in the same way. You know, you can say, can you marbun me something? So can you give me something out of compassion?
Mm. Oh, that's wonderful. And I love the Creole words sexy, S-E-K-S-I, and greedy, G-R-I-D-I. Can you tell us about sexy and greedy?
Yeah, sure. So sexy, of course, you know, comes from sexy in English. The orthography, by the way, like is something that people use, but, you know, I see Creole written on Facebook or text messages and, you know, people spell it as they wish.
Right.
Yes, so sexy. And it doesn't really mean, so in English, sexy is a physical attribute, right? It's the way someone looks, I guess. Or you could say to act sexy is something about your appearance. In Creole, sexy is something of that, but there's also an intention. So someone is described as sexy. It's not so much, it's the way you look, but it's also being flirtatious. Mm. A typical example, if you use these words, speakers will come up with examples. Oh, you know, these young women, sort of like teenagers who walk around the community, you know, and sort of like they're parading around, you know, showing themselves in the community. So that's this word encapsulates a very, very sort of quite typical behavior and also a set of values around this behavior. One thing that I find interesting with sexy is that if you speak to an older person, it's definitely condemned. But obviously, if you speak to a younger person who actually likes to walk around and parade around, of course, they're not as judgmental.
Sure. So,
yeah. And greedy also, greedy, of course, coming from greedy in English. But again, the sense is slightly, the nuance is slightly different. It means selfish, but modularly it has a sense of, you know, a personality feature of someone who keeps things to themselves in terms of being unwilling to share, and in particular, unwilling to share food. And that relates to what we were talking about earlier about the feel sorry and the, you know, the sense of compassion and the moral imperative to share and care. So greedy is someone who doesn't do that. So it's much broader than and I guess, yeah, much more morally connoted than greedy in, or the moral connotations are different than with greedy in English.
And these are examples, I might have this wrong, but these are examples where the semantics overlaps more closely with the traditional language than it does with English.
Yeah, absolutely. So you have equivalent, words with equivalent meaning for sexy and greedy in Taliban, but also for a lot with a lot of other languages around.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
So you make the point that these overlaps do need to be seen in the bigger, these overlaps between Creole and Dalabon, these examples that you provide in the book, should be seen in a bigger context, because the meanings of the Dalabon terms sometimes share a similar semantic space with terms from other languages in Australia. Or to put it another way, it's a mistake to fixate on Dalabon as a unique special case in Australia. So absolutely. Can you illustrate this for us, some of these longer range?
Yes, I would like to. I would like to clarify something potentially for the more sort of like the Creolists in the audience, is that the purpose in the book is not to claim that Dalabon has influenced Creole directly. Like, you know, there is, linguists are often keen to trace the origins of words and meanings and grammar. And this is not what I'm trying to do in the book. Like, I'm not claiming that Dalabon has influenced, you know, the sense of sorry in particular, because the influence could come from elsewhere in Australia. Right. And indeed, if you take sexy, for instance, there's evidence that there are words with similar profiles elsewhere in Australia. For instance, there is this lovely article from Yasmin Mushabash. It's a 2010 article, I think, which is about love and marriage and its contemporary, how these things around love and marriage are acted upon in contemporary Australia, so the recent evolution. And she identifies the words lover boy and lover girl. And there's not too much detail in the article about them, but I feel that from what she gives, it seems very, very similar to this sense of, like, you know, sex, people who are sexy in the Creole sense. So these teenagers who walk around in search for a lover.
Yeah, great. And when you zoom out to look at these other hundreds of other Australian languages, we start to see, you know, more of these long distance patterns. And something that really surprised me from your book is the colexifications across space and across language families. Can you tell the listeners what a colexification is, and perhaps give an example of one?
Sure. So colexification is, in fact, it's a complicated word to say something very simple. It's when a single word encapsulates several meanings. And an example in English, for instance, is the word sibling, which colexifies the meaning brother and the meaning sister. So you have these two words, but you can also say sibling, and you mean both at the same time. So you say then that it's a colexification, that the word sibling colexifies the meaning brother and sister. And of course, that's a simple example, but there are things that can be a bit more a bit less intuitive in the sense of, for instance, there is this word in Creole, which is liking Michel. So that comes from the etymology in English would be the verb like and myself. She's the reflexive pronoun. So, but liking Michel means a range of things, and it means both to be flirtatious, so it's the same sort of connotations as sexy. It's very similar. It's about parading around, etc. Liking Miss Mitchell also means to be proud, and it comes with showing off, right? So parading around, showing off. And it also means to simply to enjoy oneself, to have a good time, enjoy oneself. And so this sort of threefold association, collexification between being flirtatious, being proud, and having a good time is something that you find equivalent collexifications in languages that are as far as Jingaloo, for instance, in the Barkindabeland, or Wiradjuri in New South Wales. So, of course, I mean, you have to be careful because collexifications can also happen by chance.
Yeah.
And I haven't investigated this in as much detail as I could say, you know, confidently, well, this word in Jingaloo and this word in Wiradjuri is exactly the same, you know. But from what you find in dictionaries and examples and descriptions, it really, really gives me a sense that you do find the same sort of association, which ultimately relates potentially on cultural association. So the cultural habit of noticing the fact that someone who's flirtatious may also be someone who's showing off, and someone also who's laughing, because flirtation is strongly associated with laughing in at least in the amongst Talabon people. So there is something of a cultural pattern here. So this is a case where a language does encapsulate a cultural pattern. And I think that it may be recurrent across Australia.
Yeah, and it's pretty extraordinary. I think when we were talking earlier about Worfian research and so on, and where just how much collexification can show us about these relationships between language and culture. But for the non-Australianists listening, or people from not from Australia, the distance, the geographic distance between Wiradjuri country and Dalabon is immense.
It's about 4,000, 5,000 kilometres, something like that,
In your book, you talk about compassionate contours. What are these and what do they do in each language, in Creole and in Dalabon?
Yeah, so this is another interesting feature of the languages in Arnhem Land, including Dalabon and other older languages and Creole. So what I've labeled it myself, you know, I don't think speakers have a name for these things, it's basically there's a melodic way of speaking. So we call it a melodic contour or a prosodic contour in linguistics, which is very marked. So in English, for instance, you can have a melodic contour where you say something like, oh, you know, and it's kind of expressing your endearment by changing the melody of your voice. In Talabon and in Creole and in some other neighboring languages, there's something extremely remarkable. So it's very hard to imitate out of the blue because it goes very high, then it goes down, then there's lengthening. So it's something like, bobala, I mean, giving it taka bla all about, something like that. So, and speakers do it quite a lot. And it's very distinctive, very characteristic. In Talabon, it's something that speakers use not just for endearment, but also for compassion, like I said before, like this sense of feeling empathetic towards someone. And also, so feeling sorry for them, but also this is something that speakers do if they witness someone feeling sorry or caring or sharing for someone else, because this is a way to flag that, oh, I like this behavior. This is endearing. I like the fact that people share and care for each other. So I am going to use this very marked contour. So so that's something, and it's carried, the form has carried through from Talabon to Creole. Although it's used perhaps slightly differently in Creole.
Mm. Yeah, that's great. So on that theme of endearment and other things, what is evaluative morphology and how does it work in Dalabon versus in Creole?
First, I think I might start by trying to define morphology. So evaluative morphology is a bit of another technical word. To talk simply about these little bits and pieces of word that you can put onto another. So and that express, for instance, endearment. So diminutives are one type of evaluative morphology, and a diminutive is something like the E in kitty in English. So, you know, you want to express the fact that something is small and potentially endearing, you put an E at the end. And evaluative morphology, marginally, is the word for this sort of small bits and pieces of words that you can put on another word and that will change, will flag that you like it, or maybe you don't like it, or, you know, so in some other languages. So English doesn't have many of them, but there's still this little E thing at the end of words. But some languages have many, and some languages also have some for negative evaluation. And in Taliban is one of these languages, like many languages in the world, that have a lot of these diminutives. There's several, several actual forms, and you can put them everywhere. And look, it's not, like I said, it's something that speakers, people in the audience, listeners who speak Spanish, Italian, Dutch, you know, these and many languages in the world do this. They have this thing that you can put you could put five in the same sentence. So
Yeah. I think it's amazing that, these Italian, Spanish, German, Polish diminutives seem to, when you were describing the Dalabon, these diminutives in Dalabon, it just seemed so similar. But my impression was in the European languages, the diminutives are sort of generically affectionate, while in Dalabon, it's more about expressing compassion. Right?
That's correct. Yes, that's correct. And across the world, endearment is the most prevalent expression of diminutives. Yes, it's the sort of like the more neutral. Yes, I have actually worked on a cross-linguistic typology of this. So I've looked at it outside of Australia, of course, with a small number of languages. So this needs to be improved. But overall, the picture is that endearment is the sort of like most common, most neutral affective value of these items. But then some continents, for instance, in Africa, it seems that African languages seem to pull them towards a more grand notion of love. So not just, endeared affection, but more like romantic love and that sort of things. And in Australia, it seems that it's more leaning towards compassion. And again, the same thing as we said before. So in the same way as speakers of Taliban will use this melodic contour when they witness somebody being compassionate or even being in grief, for instance, because that shows the right attitude towards others, they can also use diminutives to do this. So they will use this little wood that they put at the end of word to show that they like someone, they're endeared, or they feel sorry about someone, or this person is doing the right thing and being compassionate with someone else.
Yeah.
And interestingly, I would like to say that that's a good this. It's interesting to look at these two features. So on the one hand, the melodic contour, and on the other hand, the evaluative morphology, because Creole does not have the evaluative morphology, and this is because of the basic grammatical profile of the language, right? It's more like English. It keeps words apart. It doesn't stick little bits and pieces onto words. So in a sense, that's an impediment of the grammar, right? That Creole doesn't do these things. In terms of what speakers have to express, what they do is that they don't have the diminutives, but they replace the diminutives with other things to express the same thing. So, and they can use, for instance, compassionate contour, these melodic contours. Yeah. They also use things like interjections and that sort of things.
Yeah. Okay, well, let's talk about figurative language. In other words, the more metaphorical or idiomatic forms of expression. What did you discover about figurative language in the domain of emotions in both Dalabon and Creole?
So that's a very, in a sense, quite an interesting domain. In terms of figurative language, there's the main figurative representation of emotions in Dalabon has to do with the body. And so you find all these, like there's like dozens and dozens of expressions that describe emotions as a state of a body part. I'll just give a few examples. So for instance, you can say gang yo yo mu. So this, the word gang means belly, stomach, belly, and yo yo mu means to flow. And so if you say that you have a flowing belly, of course, this is metaphorical, you mean that you feel good. You feel good, or you're a nice person. So this is a metaphorical representation that involves the belly. And in Taliban, there's like dozens and dozens of those. But it's not just with the belly. Of course, there's things like the heart, which is closer to English. But the metaphors can be different. So in Taliban, having a high heart, a heart that sits up high, for instance, means that you feel strong affection for someone. And there's other body parts like the eyes, the mouth, you name it, like it's like dozens and dozens. And this is quite prevalent in the language for many, for different reasons. So first, this is not to say that it's unique at all. Many languages in the world have, or practically perhaps every language in the world does that. In English, we have broken-hearted. Mm. And Anna Wierzbicka, who's done a lot of work on emotion in language, has suggested that it may be a universal. But the number of expressions of this sort is much higher in Taliban than in English, for instance. And it's also their prevalence in language, right? You just use them all the time. And this comes also with the fact that this is the main way that emotions are represented. So it's not the only way, but one thing that you do not do in Taliban is to represent emotions as independent entities that can be forces or enemies. Or so, you know, in English, you could say, "Oh, he's being blinded by love." And when you do this, you depict love as some kind of force that's affecting your abilities, right? And it's external to you and it's affecting you. But you don't do that in Taliban because actually there's not many nouns to describe emotions. So instead, you don't describe emotions as these things that are external to you and can attack you. You describe emotions as states of your body. So that's quite an important linguistic difference. And it's quite prevalent it's a prevalent pattern in the language. It's also not unique to Taliban at all. In Australia, and in fact, most Australian languages do that. And I've recently worked on a study with the help of Kitty Ginlaginia, and we've produced a website that you can look at, which explains the patterns across the country and so on. So that's really quite a strong feature of the figurative description of emotions in Australian languages. And interestingly, in Creole, this is not carried over. So whether this is perhaps because of linguistic constraints of the grammar, there may be other reasons. In any case, Creole has a couple of expressions like this. You can say good bingy, no good bingy being your belly. And, you know, you say that it's good or bad and it means that you feel good or you feel bad. But it's not that frequent. And it is quite frequent, but not that much. And also there's not many other expressions. It's amongst the only ones that are at least somewhat frequent in the language. And so this is an aspect that the Creole lexical fabric, if you like, has not taken over from Taliban or other Australian languages. So that's a difference, but then it should be nuanced with the fact that it doesn't mean that people who speak Creole do not locate emotions in the belly, for instance. Well, they do. Yeah. And there's gestures that go along with this, etc.
Yeah. Yeah, that's really interesting. I was struck by that in your book too. I want to ask a bit of a curly question, which is, I mean, one of the findings for me, or one of the striking things, is that, you know, these things do carry through, they persist through these cultural associations. Not despite language shift. And I wondered if you could reflect on whether there are any, you know, cultural values or ideologies that may have been or may be tacitly held by Taliban people that have bolstered the continuity of culture, or at least the continuity of these shared representations, such as associations between body parts and feelings. So in other words, is there something other than language and language structure that is supporting the continuity of these kinds of persisting cultural associations?
Wow, that is a big question. First, I would like perhaps to say a few more things about the discontinuity, the linguistic discontinuity. So it's pretty clear that if you compare with respect to the figurative representations of emotions, if you compare Creole and Talabon, there is quite a bit of discontinuity there. The metaphors have not carried over. Okay. That said, it doesn't allow us to necessarily draw conclusions about conceptual people's shared representations of emotions. Like I said, it's pretty clear that there is still a strong prevalence of emotions being associated with the belly, which is a cross-continental pattern in general, not unique, but the belly is the body part that is the most frequently associated with emotions across Australian languages. Mm. And also, like I said, you can still see in linguistic features such as gestures, conventionalized gestures with, you know, people gesturing towards their belly when they talk about emotions, etc., and reproducing metaphors that have to do with flowing, for instance, that are still there. So this is a case where you know the language has changed, and then but it hasn't. People's conceptual representation don't seem to have just collapsed simply because, you know, they changed the language. They kept the representation, at least for a while. And I suppose the question of what's going to happen, you know, whether these representations will persist, it depends on people entirely to whether, you know, how their mind goes. And I suppose, yes, there could be a fact that if certain representations are not supported linguistically, they are not reinforced, you know, by constantly talking about emotions in the language as if they were states of the body, which they are, by the way. So if we don't have this sort of background of linguistic metaphors, perhaps this will allow representations to change quicker. However, ultimately, we don't know that. This could be interesting to sort of come back in 20 years and see what it's like. But the other thing is that I believe it's important to keep in mind that speakers remain agents in this because, you know, they may, if these representations are really important and fundamental to the way they function in life, I would be tempted to believe that they will simply keep them and that these representations will even resurface in language elsewhere. But of course, this is all speculation. I mean, we're sort of stepping out of the realm of what I have explored empirically and sort of speculating about, you know, people's minds, etc., which I don't think it's unfair to speculate, but we just need to remember that at the moment, this is not something I can answer on empirical grounds.
That's the joy of podcasting, I think we can do this. And you've given a very good answer, I think, and you've answered my follow-up question. So I'll skip to, we're getting towards the end. I just want to ask what is it that you think all of us still need to learn about language shift to a Creole?
That's a very good question. I think perhaps this is a question that we need to ask to Creole speakers. I mean, it's really interesting because, well, I might turn the question back to you.
Okay.
Who is we in this?
Right. Okay. Well, I was hoping would be a very much an inclusive of speakers of Creole English, Australian English, and so on. But I mean, I feel like your work, not just this book, but your work generally opens up these questions that a lot of people don't even consider to be lurking there underneath.
Well, I might answer your question because I mean, it sounded perhaps like a nasty question when I turned the question of the we back to you, but actually I was really wondering because it could be about like we as linguists, like, you know, like scientifically, or it could be we as a community with perhaps hopefully a moral duty to, you know, be as less discriminative against others as possible. So I think perhaps if it's we as a general we, including everybody, perhaps we could start with something very simple, is that I do this test every semester in all my classes with all my students. Students in linguistics, they usually know about the existence of Kriol, K-R-I-O-L, in Australia. Mm-hmm. So this is a language that has 20,000 speakers, 20 to 30,000 indigenous speakers in Australia. This is the most widespread indigenous language in the country.
Yeah.
Anytime I speak to students, usually they're like advanced students, like third year, fourth year honor students in social sciences, political sciences, anthropology. Maybe 1% of them knows about Kriol.
Wow.
1% of them knows that there's a language in their own country, which numbers, you know, that many speakers of Australian, of indigenous, you know, which is the most widespread indigenous language with that many speakers. They just don't even know. And probably because I'm French, usually they say, oh, yeah, we know Kriol. You mean from the French islands? And I'm like, nah. So I think perhaps what we learn when we as a society, as a community, need to learn about Kriol is that it exists and where it is and to the extent to, you know, very descriptive knowledge, to what extent it's different from English, to what extent it resembles English, and how people who speak it feel about it, and that could be a good start. Now then, as a linguist and also perhaps a member of the community, I would be curious to perhaps understand more of the nexus between Kriol and Aboriginal English.
Okay.
The resemblances and the differences between the two and how the speakers also feel about these differences.
Yeah, I mean, that's a terrific response. And I think, I'm a bit shocked by your students
shocked every time.
Look, it's our responsibility too. It's everyone's responsibility to know about the country that they occupy.
I'm not blaming the students. If it was like a few ignorant people who had been left aside, but it's like the vast majority.
Okay.
In fact, a colleague of mine who's a prominent historian recently working on Australian matters also said, you know, confessed very, very candidly that she also didn't know about it.
Right.
So there's a problem there. And another friend of mine who's a colleague, you know, who's a philosopher, she, when I said that to her, like, she was like, and she said, but why are people so ignorant? They're like, I don't know.
I mean, I was also thinking of Kriol with a C, because I mean, the first step is knowing about Kriol with a K. But then, as you've pointed out, once you know about that, there's a whole range of prejudices around Kriol with a K. And then there's also a whole range of prejudices around Krioles, plural, with a C. And there's the entire very fiercely fought Kriol debate, which I won't ask you to rehash here.
No,
so
thanks.
I mean, even before we get anywhere, it sounds like there's a lifetime of work, both, you know, linguistic work and social work that needs to be done.
Yeah.
I'll ask you one last question, which is, what is it that you're working on right now?
Yes, so right now I am working on three things. So I'm finishing to write an article about body-based emotion metaphors in Australian languages. So this is something that I've already, I've got a more linguistic article on it, which is about to be published, and there's also a more broad audience website. But I decided that I also wanted to do an article on this that would be targeting more like anthropologists. So, and I wanted to mention this work that I'm doing at the moment because I feel that it's important to talk across disciplines. So, you know, I thought, okay, I've got this linguistic article, but it's fairly technical, it's fairly long. So I'm not going to reach the anthropologists with this, although, you know, and also archaeologists can actually be interested in this because it's important semiotically, people who work on rock art and this sort of thing. So I decided to do this to make the effort to write this additional article, which is for an academic audience, a scholarly audience, but not technically linguistic. So that's one thing that I'm doing. Another thing is that I am also working with the help of a student on the contours that we talked about, the melodic contours and how they function in other languages than Taliban, in particular the Rembagan language. And I have another collaborative student project with a student and another colleague on emotions and how emotion terms and the treatment of emotions in the media have changed with COVID. So you see that it's quite a broad range of interest. In the future, I hope to also do more, and I've also started to do more more work that allow us to understand further the question of the influence of a language one speaks outside of language shift, the influence of the linguistic tools that are available to a given human being on the way they experience emotions. So in other words, if you have a diminutive in your language that allows you to easily express compassion and endearment and this sort of, is it going to mean that perhaps these values that are attached to compassion are going to be more more easily communicated and thus therefore more frequently communicated in your community, which perhaps in turn could modify your values and perhaps your own emotional experience?
That all sounds absolutely terrific. And thank you very much for your time. It's been fantastic having you on the podcast.
Yes, that was also a lot of fun for me. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Maya. Bye.
Bye.